Okay, so tonight's theme is ritual and devotion. So let us look at what we mean by ritual. So we've looked at the levels of wisdom last week. So kind of ritual and devotion follows on from that. So the levels of wisdom we saw are a journey from, you could say a journey from information, the doctrine, the techniques. You read them, you get them on an app, or somebody tells you about them. So they're information, but then hopefully over time they become, the ideal is they become wisdom. They through working on them, through that determination, persistent use of exploration of the teachings in a very practical way, you attain, at least ideally, wisdom. So that, in a sense, your life is consistent with the teachings. However, that's not an easy journey for most of us. Whatever our values, actually, for most of us, there's a gap between our values and what we do. So, or our knowledge and how we behave. So I might know that crisps, I enjoy crisps, but they're not particularly healthy for me, whereas the tofu, it's healthy for me. But which one will I actually go for when it comes to the crunch, if you will, excuse the pun? Or, you know, I'm tired, I get home, I'm tired, I know what I need to do is go to bed, but actually I just get this idea, I'll put a box set on, I'll just watch 10 minutes of something just to help me relax, and I'm still there three episodes later, and it's like, I knew what was good for me, but have I done it?
Yeah.
Or exercised, you know, I should do whatever, I know I should do, and I don't, because... various excuses. So knowing the truth is not the same as behaving from the truth, what one reckons to be the truth. So this is a challenge which all spiritual systems really work with. So St. Paul says, I fail to do the things I want to do, and I find myself doing the very things I hate. Romans 7:15.
I do the opposite.
So,
I really understand that. He does the things
I fail to do the things I want to do.
Oh.
In a sense, he knows he wants to be a good Christian.
Yeah.
In St. Paul's case.
Yeah.
But can he? No, he struggles.
Mm.
And in his book, that's it's all about sin.
Mm.
Whereas what we're looking at really is habits. That's what we've been looking at over the weeks. We're looking at our conditioning. The habits come out of our conditioning. Previous actions, our culture, our how we were brought up. So we're working against that, our habits. Habitual behaviour patterns. And in order to behave the way we want to, often we'll have to break through. We'll have to get into the gap with awareness and try and break those habits. And it's, to some extent, a gradual process of acquiring skills. The skills of meditation to support your skills of awareness on the fly. Your ethics, that's we use the language of skillfulness or unskillfulness. Because it's something we can learn, we can train in, and behind that we can back it all up by study, by gaining the knowledge, the theoretical knowledge, and then that gives us a kind of mental framework around which we can work. And to some extent, that's what we've been doing on the course. But in all of this, effort is required. Discipline, whether it's in meditation, you probably already experienced, just
working in meditation is, it can be work. It can be quite pleasurable, and as time goes on, it gets more pleasurable. But it can be work. Just even taking time out, making sure, prioritizing a particular time of day, you know, that's a discipline and takes effort, because there are many other good things you could be doing. Ethical behavior takes it, it's not that straightforward in the sense of applying the precepts. It can be quite tricky, just weighing up the different precepts in a given situation. And it, you know, some people are more into studying and informing, getting a sense of the teachings. Some people are really into study, some people are not. So for some people, it's a real effort to engage with the teachings. So it requires discipline, it requires patience and determination. And this is perhaps particularly, maybe it's always been the case, we humans tend to dwell in a certain comfort zone. I think it is actually true that modern culture is quite comfort orientated. You know, we so many labor saving devices, with so many options available to us. People are quite ingenious in addressing our needs for culture, for comfort. But there's something about going outside of our comfort zone, you know, like paddling up a river or
camping
in a field at this time of year. But it's exhilarating. Getting into the sea certainly was exhilarating. So motivation is essential. If we're going to bridge the gap between our values and our behaviour, we need to be motivated. We need to be wholehearted. We need to be emotionally engaged. And this is the emotion, you could say, is an energy. It's probably in your experience, you know that if your heart is behind something, it's going to get done. If it's not, fat chance. And this really applies to breaking through habits, becoming the person we want to be. So the founder of our tradition, Sangharakshita, this Triratna tradition, he said that the availability of emotional energy is actually the key issue in the spiritual life on the Buddhist path. So we need to attend to that. How can we get the rocket fuel, if you like? How can we bring all the solar panels and wind turbines behind our spiritual life and get the energy we need? And I experience the range, and like any given day, the range of energy that's available to me. You know, there may be some days when just getting out of bed is a bit of a struggle, and there are other days. You know, if you find yourself in love, you will travel any distance. You will move mountains. You can imagine yourself into that situation. You'll just do anything. Nothing will stop you. So you know. Those, they're two kind of extremes where we, such a variability in our energy and the difference, that the lack of empowerment and the empowerment between the two, the determination. So we're talking here about in this wholeheartedness, we're talking about applied to the particular context of Buddhism. So how do Buddhists translate the teachings and the ethical, the meditation, the wisdom, how do we translate that into our day-to-day lives in behavior? How do we respond to these truths, these practices, with all of ourselves, wholeheartedly, not just our minds. It's not just that we know what Buddhism teaches us, but with our hearts, that we really want to do it. So our wills as much as our intellect. So this possible response, wholehearted, all of us at the table response, is given a name in Buddhism. Every now and again, I throw in a Pali word, don't I? Just because they're not easy to translate into English, or at least the translations rarely do justice. And this is a really good example. Shraddha is the word. Shraddha. You can think of a shredder. This is Shraddha. And faith, so it's an example of a word that if you translate, or it can be translated as faith. So you experience the truth, whether it's this second noble truth that the cause of suffering is craving, or just the usefulness of meditation, or mindfulness, these teachings. So it's, you can imagine just believing in them. That's kind of a sense of faith. Certainly in the Christian tradition, faith is the acceptance of truths on the basis of the authority of who you get those truths from, whoever teaches the truths, without the need for proof or demonstration. So it's acceptance on trust, really. A bit like what we were doing in the first stage of wisdom with the listening. We were just kind of at least provisionally taking on board whatever the teachings were, and with a view then to trying them out. Faith in the traditional Christian sense is just seen as a value in itself, just accepting things. Often the word is blind faith, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just accepting them on the basis of the authority of whoever you hear from. Buddhism doesn't have that sense of faith. Certainly Shraddha does not mean that. The better translation for Shraddha is confidence, trust. So I'll just elaborate a little bit on confidence, trust. Let me see, how am I doing for time? I'm really quite keen on this term Shraddha, confidence, trust, so I can get a bit carried away with it, but I need to keep an eye on time with a few bits to get through. But please, yeah, I really enjoy the questions. When please, at any stage, do pop in with a question, because then it's more real for you if you have questions that I can attempt at least to answer. A little bit behind, but hey. So there are three characteristics of Shraddha. The head, they're to do with the head, the heart, and the, if you like, either the feet or the hands. So they're to do with the head is kind of, okay, we hear a truth, like last session we heard about impermanence and dukkha and interconnection, and you may think, oh well, okay, that makes sense. So you kind of give rational assent to it. You use your critical faculties, and you think, oh yeah, okay, I'll go with that. It's not ridiculous. Seems reasonable. So that's the first part of Shraddha. So it's not just accepting truths on because of who says them. It's yeah, they make sense to me. So it's a cognitive head response to the truth. That makes sense. The second is a heart response. It's kind of a spontaneous emotional response to the truth. And sometimes, it can't be forced, but sometimes, you know, you'll hear something and you'll think, wow, there's something beautiful about that teaching. Sometimes, you know, I used to do a lot of maths, and sometimes a proof, mathematical proof, can be beautiful, elegant. I used to play a lot of chess. Sometimes a chess combination can be beautiful. Similarly, truths can have a real coherence, particularly in the, oh yeah, that really fits in with everything else I know. And then there's a sense of, for me, aesthetic beauty to it. And maybe other aspects of heart come in, of an emotional response, like maybe appreciation, gratitude, joy, perhaps. This is where reverence or devotion, they're aspects of Shraddha, of confidence, trust, where you enjoy, there's a heart response to the truth, and you feel, along with the gratitude, it's like, yeah, I can put myself into this, I can put myself behind this, I can support this, a kind of sense of reverence, devotion, they kind of go together. And they are two of the possible heart responses to the truth that, that ritual will really express and develop. So, but I'll come to that. So there's a can be this compelling quality to truths. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. It's kind of elegant. There's a beauty to it. I want to actually engage in some way with this truth. So there can be an impulse towards action, towards trying it out, perhaps, in our own lives. So if you like the idea of, you know, sitting on a cushion and meditating, if that appeals to you, that could be an example. Or if you like the sense of bringing mindfulness into the gap, or bringing awareness into the gap and working with your habits. So that's the beauty of the Buddhist teachings. They are, to a large extent, very practical. You can try them out. You can engage with them on a practical level and experience whether they work for you or not. And if they do, well, then you become confident. You think, okay, that worked. I'll try it again. So, you know, I woke up angry at my routine being disturbed again, and you meditated and something happened. And so, you know, you can, out of your experience, gain a certain confidence, trust in the practices. Again, not because someone else has said, this is what you need to do, because of your experience. And we might find that with meditation, with mindfulness, with ethics. We might find, now, as we get more kind to people, or generous, or truthful, that actually, that our lives, people are more truthful, more kind, more generous to us. Our lives improve, the quality of our lives improve. Well, we're happier people, perhaps. So that can give us more confidence, trust in the teachings, and then we apply them more. And then that gets into a kind of virtuous circle, if you like. So that's a path of Shraddha, increasing confidence, trust, which, and that trajectory is a trajectory towards wisdom in the Buddhist tradition. So a kind of combination of action and confidence. You could describe it as kind of a recognition of what is good for us. If it works for us and we try it out, and we're kind of prepared to invest in it. You know, you see something of value, you say that is worthwhile. You're prepared to invest more time, more energy. Tonight I seem to be dipping into the Bible a lot, the New Testament. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field which a man found and covered up. Then in his joy he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. I like that. It has a sense of somebody recognizing what's good for them. They find the treasure in the field, so they invest what they've got into that. They put their energies into it. They kind of reorientate their lives to make use of that, what they find is of value, to align themselves with it. Yeah, maybe we'll, I have a little section here. Normally I open it up and say, well, you know, have you had experiences of applying the teachings that we've been covering over the past few weeks and in your own lives? So Susie, you've given an example already. I don't know if you and you were giving an example of this, mm-hmm. as well, weren't you, mm-hmm. that you found a bit calm and kind of,
mm-hmm.
Just turning towards the sense of turning towards suffering makes a lot of that sense.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's like, I was just thinking, is there being, well, actually, do you remember when I originally came and I told the worktop story? And then I just decided, you know, to keep on pursuing it, you know. I was just like, I just found a better context and just sort of came to an acceptance, because I knew that to continue, you know, although I felt wronged, that, you know, I think after that session I still had to deal with it. And I did, I was like, we were talking before, I did write a letter on the principle of it. To be honest, I got a very, you know, what I thought was a very standard response, shifting the blame. But I just decided it just wasn't, it was just going to bring more suffering to keep on, like I had a pause in a moment, of, like, rather than, and just think, well, it's just going to cause more suffering. So what is it, how important is it really, you know? And then my friends all turned up and said, it's really nice anyway. but
she used to get friends with better taste.
No, but I did just kind of go, I just sat there and I thought, I'm not going to give myself any more, you know. And that was definitely, yeah, take out on that. But I did remember you saying that that self-care, the self, looking after self, was really important, which is why I wrote the letter, because I felt like the email to them, I still felt like I had to have my voice and have my opinion, not, you know, as you said before, not to be trampled all over. Buddhism isn't about being trampled over. But I knew, I could see that their process was only going to keep giving me more suffering if I kept on banging my whole head against it, you know. So it's just like, forget it, and just, it's fine, you know.
Sometimes just letting go is the most appropriate thing to do.
Yeah. And there's just been other little things where I've just thought, yeah, I've just applied it.
Well, can you think, Lucy, of any?
Yes, time? I can think of some things. I mean, one, I feel a bit funny about talking about it, only because I feel like suddenly that means I'm doing it for my own. Oh, aren't I great? I've been so helpful to somebody. So I sort of feel like somehow it's better just to do it and keep quiet about it, not tell anyone. But it's fine, because it's just a funny...
Only what feels comfortable for you.
No, it's fine, but it's just it's funny that that thought's in my mind. Well, maybe if you say it, then that's a real ego-y thing. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just... occasionally I get people, you know, recommending youngsters to chat to me about careers and, you know, just what I do for a living. And just taking, I always take time to speak to them and I have a call with them. But there's a couple, and then I'll normally be too busy and just sort of do what I can, and then, you know, they never ask again to meet up a third time. But yeah, just sort of taking proper time to just really listen, like you say, really listen to what's going on. Some, you know, attractive, enthusiastic, kind of bright-eyed girl, and then feeling like there's some other stuff going on, and just really listening and just asking the right questions occasionally, and kind of realizing that actually it's what we all know, isn't it? When you do feel you can change someone's life a little bit, just in terms of giving them a dollop of confidence that they need, or a direction, or a, which other people have done for me, it's actually, you know, you get it back in space. It's a nice thing. It feels nice to do. And I'm not saying I didn't do that before, but I suppose I'm more conscious of perhaps as well feeling like it's an unusual period for me, because I'm not working flat out. I'm not working at all at the moment, but just sort of enjoying having the time to do certain things. you know, having time to like drive my daughter to school this morning, she wasn't expecting it, just to have precious time with her, you know, and when you're, it's only like a 15-minute journey, I thought, no, she said, oh, you're offering to take me to school, do you want to, she said, and I said, yes, I actually want to, you know, normally she's like, will you take me to, so demanding, will you take me to school, I'm like, no, you can get the bus like everybody else, you know, no, but, you know, just, so sort of, yeah, valuing time with people and friends and making the effort to go and see a friend who's lost somebody, making sure I visit him. You know, I didn't ever used to visit him when his wife was around. She was more my friend. But just, yeah, just
acts of kindness.
Yeah, just, yeah, I guess.
And maybe, you know, you would have performed those acts of kindness anyway, but there's something I think valuable about that. Having that framework of the precepts that, and applying it and thinking, oh yeah, I was generous there. That kind of appreciation of one's own acts is it's awareness. It's reality. It's there can be a part of us which kind of, oh, you know, that's a bit self indulgent or conceited. But it's just recognizing reality. You've been generous to either other people or yourself, and that's conforms with that follows the Buddha's advice, counsel, if you like, on tips as to how to live a happy life that will make the people around us happier.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just recognizing what's what, in a sense. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have any additional aren't I great laid on top. Obviously that can happen, but it doesn't have to be. Just a straightforward appreciation, acknowledgement of that you've been generous.
Yeah, that's the good side. I'm also aware of sort of the things that I actively avoid that I don't enjoy, like taxes, like accounts, like sorting out finances, because I'm worried about it, and so I avoid it. And I do all these other things. So
So you also, you can be aware of that, and you can just perhaps see it. You don't need to beat yourself up about it. You can just think, oh well, that's a very human response to what we have aversion towards, is to turn away and do plenty of other things, because there's no shortage of things to be done. But sometimes we can just be kinder to ourselves by saying, no, I'm going to actually turn towards it and experience the aversion. Okay, well, that's unpleasant.
Yeah.
And see that awareness.
Yeah.
See what happens with that.
Yes.
See. It's interesting. There was a piece on the radio recently about procrastination.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big thing for productivity, the productivity industry, and coaching. We all do it, I think. We all tend to. Perhaps maybe I'm generalizing, but
everybody does.
Certain things just get put to the bottom of the list again and again and again, but as part of us knows, you know, I need to turn towards that.
Yeah. And the feeling sometimes when you avoid it and you avoid it and then you do it, and it's such a relief. And a,
why didn't I do that?
Yeah.
It
was
so
again,
simple.
And again, you know that, like the crisps, the tofu.
Yeah.
But
actually,
why is
doing
it so
it,
hard?
Yeah.
Yeah, because we're habitual beings, aren't we?
Maybe that's built into our hardwiring
or
something.
No, because everyone will have a different one, do you know what I mean? For some people, let's just say tax, for some people that's not their thing.
Mm.
Everyone will have a different...
Mm.
If you're an extrovert, the chat is, you know, that's the go-to. But if you're an introvert, it's like, oh, I'll do that later.
If you're methodical and you enjoy having everything done and you like maths and paperwork, then that's just, ooh, you know. And then for other people, it's like, oh, I'll just put it off. I can't face it and it's so much work. And I've got to go through everything, find all those receipts and do-do-do, you know. You're like, oh, why, you know. And then, but when you get it done, it's like, great.
But what is habitual is just pushing away, looking away from what we don't like, the aversive, and grasping onto the what we do like.
Excellent, excellent.
Just finally, it's not a big thing at all, but I feel a very, like it's a highlight of my week. Kind of thing. I love coming here. I love this space, and it's just a really special thing to do. You know, and I'm sometimes sit here thinking, oh God, I should have meditated. What's the point of doing a course like this if I haven't meditated? And then I think, yeah, but I'm listening, taking in. I'm here. I'm showing up, and actually, it's something I do want to do more of. So it sort of feels like at least it's a half a step.
You might not be meditating, but it's 2 hours of giving yourself to something like this, you know, that's the self-care, and it's just as good as the meditate in a way.
And recognising that you're looking for something.
And we'll all have our own paths too, you know, we'll all latch on to different aspects of it, and then it can branch out from there. So maybe the meditation you find actually works, and you work with that for a while, but then you find actually something like ritual might throw another angle or give another tool, or the ethics might be what really jumps out at you as the kind of something you can get your handle on, and maybe the meditation further down the line. So we all have our different paths, really, I think.
It's not like if you don't meditate, because that's not like the gateway into everything else.
Some people would say, I think any part of the practice, and we've all got, I'll finish my sentence, any part of the practice can be the gateway. And we've all got different temperaments, and that will to some extent determine, I think, what we find as our entry path.
It's interesting what you just said, because you could start off with something and then come back, you find something else.
Joseph Campbell, he was the philosopher, cultural writer, he wrote a lot about myth. He would say, follow your bliss. That's his piece of advice to anybody, just follow your bliss. Because if you like doing what you're doing, you'll do more of it. But if it's a trial, then you probably won't continue with it. Or when the going gets tough, maybe it'll fall to one side. But if you can really find the enjoyment, and if there's that kind of reward that comes through following it, then you're more likely to stick with it. And then potentially see how other aspects of the same path also might work for you. The next topic is the ally that we have. So where we're at now is we're looking at heart. How to bring heart, or the need to bring heart to any teaching that we want to put into practice. If we want to change habits, for example, we need to be wholehearted about our desire to practice, to meditate, to be ethical, to study. There is a great ally we have potentially to generate energy around this, to engage our emotional energy. So that's what we'll look at after a tea break.
Great, great. Wholehearted is interesting, interesting.
Life is different, isn't it, when it's wholehearted?
Yes.
And I have a friend who wholehearted also is a...
Thank you for reminding me. Yes, so imagination is an ally to in us engaging our hearts, being wholehearted in whatever we're doing, but also on the Buddhist path.
I don't really understand what imagination links to wholeheartedness.
Right, well, what are the fields of imagination? Song, music, art, poetry, song, and these all work with images, if you like. It's like imagination, it's about images. I'm using images in the broadest sense, not just visual. So in the sense that what a musician does is they come up with sound images, don't they? So they, you know, some beautiful piece of music can just evoke an emotion through a certain image, a musical image. It's a gift of the musician. So what images are, that they're a particularly immediate way of engaging with the world. Whereas concepts, you know, the labels we stick on things are a kind of a medium for engaging with the world. Images are more immediate. It's a more direct grasp of the world. That's why I think they are so powerful, why images have such an impact on us. And I think some people are more word people and some people are more image people. But I think there's a sense in which images are non-conceptual and they do provide a more direct experience of the world and the world, and therefore perhaps more powerful image, an engagement with the world which is more emotionally charged, engaged. So there are particular images, particularly powerful images, which we call symbols, which have a particular ability to engage our emotions, if you like, get into us, into our depths. So I'll just say something about symbols, and we'll explore the why. So I'll see if it's making sense. Symbols are concrete images, and like the Buddha image that we have here. So it represents something abstract, you could say. So that Buddha image, at least one thing it represents is the ideal of enlightenment in a concrete image. And there's something about, so a symbol points beyond itself. So that it's an image of a man in meditation posture, but it's pointing beyond that. But there's something contained in the image that points beyond it. You know, maybe the sense of serenity on the face. Maybe the posture says something. So another symbol could be a flower. So a flower, maybe you could say a flower is a symbol of impermanence, for example. Just as we've seen, flowers that today, there's this ritual where we say flowers that today are fresh and sweetly blooming, flowers that tomorrow are faded and fallen. So I think in many cultures a flower is a symbol of impermanence. So impermanence is kind of an abstract thing, but a flower just kind of can capture it. It's pointing beyond its own form. Candles can be a symbol as well. So in many traditions, the candle is a symbol of wisdom. So on Easter Saturday, for example, it used to be my favourite ritual when I was a Catholic, the Easter Saturday ceremony of light. So you have the Paschal candle and people come up and light their candles. So everybody in the church has the church is dark, in dark, total darkness, and then the candles are kind of fanned out. Everybody lights other people's. By the end, you know, there's a whole church full of candles. Nice. And it's kind of a beautiful sense of light. The fire communicates itself without being used up. So the fact that you light other people's candles doesn't mean your candle is diminished. So there are all sorts of aspects to the symbol, which I think is very strong. But you know, the light of knowledge, the light of kindness, the light of wisdom, all of those meanings are potentially there in the symbol of the candle and the image. So these images, these symbols, kind of speak to our depths in some way. They bypass the thinking, calculating, analysing mind, and some way that they're more raw, is how I would put it. And poetry works on the basis of these kind of images. Okay, it's through words, but you know, the images that are there in poetry, through the metaphors, the similes, the allegories, often with lots of levels of meaning. Just like, say, a flower, so it might have that meaning of impermanence, but it also might have connotations with royalty, you know, the fleur-de-lis, or it might have connotations with romantic love, you know, flowers, Valentine's Day, red roses. So poetry uses this multivalence of images, the fact that we can have lots of different associations with the same image. It gives much greater richness to the images. And that's why I think poetry can be so effective. It kind of, a piece of poetry and a piece of prose can, if it's good poetry, it can just really register on a different level. So I'm talking about symbols as special images, more powerful images. But there's either particular symbols which are particularly powerful, and that's archetypes. And these come up into story a lot, you know, particularly myth. So we have these archetypes of the hero, or the trickster, or the wise one, the Senex, or the Dark Lord, Sauron. Star Wars body.
Darth Vader.
Darth Vader, thank you. Or Eros, or Dionysus. These are all kind of archetypal figures that inhabit stories. Jung did a lot of work looking at archetypes, and he reckoned the reason they're so powerful and they're there and kind of universally around the different cultures is that they represent patterns of our psyche, universal patterns. Once you're a human, you have a certain pattern of your psyche, and that's where, and these archetypes come out of that. And he's quite mystical, Jung, and he would say that actually, it's not that we have these archetypes, it's that the archetypes have us. They're kind of an energy that almost possess us. And we become the archetype. Our behaviour kind of conforms to the archetypal behaviour. Like the archetype is acting through us. So there's a sense in which there's a compulsiveness, there's a latent energy within us that is activated when we are engaging with the archetype. Energies that perhaps are normally just in our unconscious or subconscious psyche.
Could you say that last sentence again?
So these energies, the archetypal energies, and maybe the symbols as well, they kind of are there, dormant.
When you say archetypal energies, I mean, I can see archetypes, as you say, like heroes or these different characters, like a cast.
Sometimes perhaps a particular archetype really resonates for you,
okay,
and you wonder why. Why is that?
Okay.
It's like it's calling in some sense to you.
Okay.
Or a particular story that you hear really is resonating. You wonder, what is it about that story that is really stirring me up?
Mm.
Mm. So So I'm talking generally there that the imagination and the products of the imagination, you know, images, symbols, archetypes, they're all, they have the potential to go quite deep and engage us on a level which is not particularly rational, not necessarily rational, although there might be a rational aspect to them, but it kind of stirs up the cauldron of our depths. So there's this sense that we have this rational bit and we have this massive sea of the subconscious mind. So ritual, finally getting around to the topic of this evening really, ritual harnesses the power of the imagination, makes use of symbols, images, archetypes, in order to express or to give us the possibility to express our inner landscape. One definition of ritual from Eric Fromm, the psychotherapist, philosopher, psychotherapist, is ritual is a symbolic expression of thought and feeling through action. So it's symbolic, ritual is a symbolic expression of thought and feeling through action. So it's an expression, it externalizes an inner landscape, something going on inside, and through ritual we can get it out there. And it's through actions, it is expressed through symbolic actions. So what might be symbolic actions? So in Buddhism, traditionally, one will place flowers on the shrine or light a candle. That they are symbolic actions. They can be symbolic actions. If the intention behind it is about, say for example, reverence. So I can light a candle and it can be an act of respect, of tuning in a sense to the Buddha or the ideal of enlightenment. It can be through physical gestures. So this, just, you know, you're all familiar with this. This is kind of universal, isn't it? It can be a symbol of prayer, or it can be a symbol of respect. Dance is a physical gesture. There's a particular physical gesture going on here. The Buddha is touching. It's called the earth touching mudra, mudra meaning a kind of gesture. So there's a whole story behind, before the Buddha was enlightened, how he was challenged by Mara. I think I might have mentioned this in week one. He was challenged, you know, by what right do you think you're ready to be enlightened? And he touches the earth with that gesture, and an earth goddess appears and says, yeah, I can testify to the fact that in previous lives the Buddha practiced and is now ready for enlightenment. So gestures, so dance, also we can vocalize as a means of expressing. So we can, words can be used to express that inner landscape, if you like. Song, chant, we'll do, hopefully have time for an example of a mantra. So a mantra is a particular form of chant in the Buddhist tradition, which strings together sound syllables into a short phrase that you can repeat. Hopefully, you know, in a Buddhist ritual, and hopefully again we'll do a little, I'll give you a little example of a traditional Buddhist ritual. There's a set of words, and hopefully the words are poetic. Hopefully that they are, you know, an aesthetically pleasing combination of words, even poetic combination of words. Really, any action can be, any action or gesture can be a symbolic action. can be part of a ritual. As long as the intention is there behind it, that's the crucial part. So again, what we're talking about symbols as pointing beyond the action. So for example, you know, there are plenty of examples of symbolic actions that express inner landscape. So for example, during lockdown, we were banging on Thursday evenings, we were kind of supporting the NHS, showing some support for the NHS at 7 o'clock on a Thursday evening. When people at the beginning of a sports event take the knee, that's a symbolic gesture, isn't it? In solidarity with Black Lives Matter, or against racism. When you see it's quite poignant, isn't it, when you see on the road a little almost shrine of flowers, and you know somebody must have been killed there. So somebody got the flowers with the intention of marking this person's life or the accident. So there's an expression of an inner state, whether it's gratitude or respect or grief, through an external action. So it's an externalization of an internal feeling. So I've been describing it as kind of an inner landscape. And that's quite powerful for people. It can be very powerful, I think. There are so many rituals out there, so many ritualistic expressions. It was very strong during the Queen's funeral. There were so many symbolic actions, and you know, the commentators were constantly going on, oh well, this was started at the time of Queen Victoria, and this is why we have this set of people doing what they're doing, and that sort of, and the rod, and it's like, wow, there's just so many symbols. So why, you know, all the flowers, God, it's a sea of flowers. It's clear that the ritual is important to people, really, in society. So it expresses, rituals express symbolically internal states and processes. Again, there are many examples, rites of passage, maybe a marriage. So there's an expression of commitment, isn't there? So that, and there are symbols like the ring, the flowers, the wedding dress. There's so many symbols in there, which are, again, if the intention, this is the key thing, they can simply be formal, this is what everyone does, and we'll do the same thing. This is what one does. Or there can be a real sense of aligning one's intention with the symbol. I think it's better when people come up with their own symbols that are really personally significant from their own imagination, that are really particular to them, to express what wants to be expressed, whether it's love or commitment. So we'll do a little, or at least I'll do a little ritual, and you can just sit back and witness it, which is about devotion or reverence to the Buddha. It's just one little section of a ritual. To give an example of a kind of symbolic set of words which are about expressing the inner language of devotion or reverence. I had a ritual, a very meaningful ritual, up a mountain in Spain 10 years ago, as it happens. When I was given this is symbolic of my ordination as a member of the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order. I was given my name, Ratnadeva, by my mentor in a beautiful ritual, and that was kind of the centre of a 4-month retreat up the mountain. So that was, and this is kind of a symbol of commitment to the Buddhist path. Being ordained was something I wanted to do in order to express that desire. But But yes, this would be a symbol of my ordination. But there are many other rites of passage, aren't there? Like bar mitzvahs, or first Holy Communion. And what these rituals do, that they make an internal situation explicit. They externalize it and make it more conscious by doing that. So often we have these feelings vaguely, and a little ritual might just express it, make it more concrete, make it more tangible, validate it, or ratify what's going on inside us. Reinforcing that. So what, there's this kind of universal psychological law that what you pay attention to, what you dwell on, grows. So if you're angry and you dwell on that, the anger will probably just escalate. If you're really grateful to someone and you really attend to the, oh yeah, what they did for you and dwell on that, then the gratitude, appreciation may grow. By spotlighting particular experiences that we have, they are intensified. They can be, at least, intensified. And I think that's what weddings do. They put a spotlight on this couple getting committing to each other. But there's an important dimension there, isn't it? The communal, well, it can be an important dimension. It can add power to any ritual when it involves the community. So it's being witnessed, whether it's a bar mitzvah, a wedding, or First Holy Communion. There's a sense of this person coming into a certain relationship with the community, and the community coming into relationship with these people. For example, in a wedding, it can be a sense that these friends who've been invited to the wedding will keep an eye out for them and kind of give them advice over the years and support them to follow through on their promises to each other. So Buddhism would say that the reason that rituals are powerful is that they engage the whole person. Again, it's not just the head, it's the head and the heart. Buddhism has a sense of us being body, speech and mind. So if we're doing gestures and saying words, then that's body. If you're saying words, that's speech. And you know, if you're really there in it, fully present in intention, your intentions are aligned with the rituals, then your mind is involved, engaged. And really, this is crucial. Intentionality, if you're just doing it because this is what we always do, or this is what my parents did, or this is what is expected in society, that's you can call it a ritual, but it's hardly what a ritual can really be. It's hardly having that psychological impact that a ritual can have if it's just automatic or mechanical. Your heart isn't, you're going through the motions. Any questions? Or is that clear about how rituals are bringing together symbols in order to express and engage and amplify the heart, if you like? How ritual can be a tool in the toolbox for engaging emotional, the emotional side of us, bringing it out, expressing it.
Everything you said makes total sense to me. The bit I don't understand is, I understand in churches the ritual, you know, the whole point of, you know, bowing down to God or whatever actually it's all about, especially in Catholic churches, or you know, that incense and the, you know, very kind of amazing kind of devotion to you know, this one God. What I'm interested in knowing more about, perhaps you're coming on to it, is how rituals are part of Buddhism.
Yeah, this is a key question.
In a non-religious
yeah.
way.
Yeah. So, well, this is actually the religious dimension of Buddhism. I think it said in the first week, in a sense, Buddhism is a religion, but in a sense, it's not. In a sense, it's a philosophy. In a sense, it's not. In a sense, it's a therapy. In a sense, it's not. So there are secular aspects to Buddhism, and like meditation, you don't have to, and a lot of people are put off by the religious aspects of Buddhism, and they can still meditate. It's a technique, a psychological technique. Some people would say that Buddhism is a psychological religion. And there is no deity, there is no supreme being in Buddhism. But Buddhism has a story about the world, has a myth, which involves, you know, figures that are kind of spirit beings, like my name, Ratnadeva. Deva is kind of a spirit being, like an angel. And it's not, Buddhism isn't saying these are literally, you know, you walking around in the midst of angels, but these are figures which are, you could see them as symbols. Some people see them as more literally, but you can see them as symbolic of our energies in the world, energies that we have to contend with. But maybe that's not quite addressing your question head on. So, given that there is no supreme being, what is it that we are revering? What is it that we are expressing devotion to?
Yes.
I would say for me, it's devotion and reverence to the values. It's devotion and reverence to my own potential as a human being. It's devotion, reverence to the possibility of enlightenment. And that's not just my enlightenment, it's like the possibility of tapping into something bigger than me. So when I bow to the shrine or light a candle, it's very much along those lines. I'm kind of commemorating the Buddha as a human being who achieved enlightenment. So I'm honoring his achievement and the achievement of all the enlightened beings down through the ages. So there are to some extent, it's not just about my potential and the values. It's also about those people who have fulfilled that potential before me in history, down through history, who have exemplified the values. So I'm honouring their embodiment of the values.
Does that
makes it a bit clearer?
Yeah,
makes sense. Very helpful.
I remember in Leith, in was it Exeter? There's a museum, really lovely museum in Exeter, the Albert Museum, I think it is. And there's a big statue of the Buddha upstairs in one of the rooms, and under it there's a Victorian label, and it says Buddhist idol. So they had a particular view when they came across Buddhism. They thought, oh, Buddhists see this Buddha and revere it and lay flowers and light candles. They could see all this happening, and they see, oh, that they're all revering a god. So, you know, we've got our Christian god. Buddhists have their Buddha god. So that's why they call it an idol. But that's not what's going on for a Buddhist, at least in traditional Buddhist terms. Obviously, Buddhism has many forms, and there are folk versions. There are some quite superstitious versions. But classically, what is happening is devotion, an expression of devotion to the ideal of enlightenment. But so easy to misinterpret, I think.
Mm.
You could.
I've never understood it. I understand it now.
Mm. Yeah.
Because from one point of view, you know, we've just been through Easter. This is the Buddhist focal point, whereas in a church, the focal point will be a crucifix. It's quite a strong contrast, isn't it? The what's that signifying? But they're just in terms of the what's going on. In terms of the relationship, it's so very different. So much more about that ideal of enlightenment which each and every one of us can aspire to and realize. So it's not something out there. That's probably the key thing. It's not out there. There's obviously I'm not enlightened yet, so in a sense it is out there, but in another sense I can achieve. Whereas in the Christian tradition, that separation is total, isn't it? There's God and there's the human.
Mm. And the saints in between.
And the saints in between. Mm. I'm glad you answered that question. That was a useful question, thank you. So maybe I'll just give one or two examples. Well, I've kind of already given examples of symbols, haven't I? The flowers, there's also incense would often be burnt, and there's a sense that the incense is the wisdom of the Buddha's teaching that goes in all directions. So the smoke from incense kind of in a room, if you light incense, well, every corner of the room will be perfumed by that. So that's another symbol. We talk about candles, so light.
What about the bell?
Oh, okay, the bell. Maybe I'll just say a few words about both of these, the vajra and the bell. Very much in evidence, to the fore in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. They're used together. You'll see practitioners kind of making movements, mudras, hand movements, with the vajra and the bell. So, and in fact, the bell you can see has a very similar feature. It's kind of just half of the vajra. So vajra is a diamond thunderbolt. It's like a coming together of opposites. The diamond is the irresistible force. Is the on the indestructible object. In a sense, diamond, and the thunderbolt is the irresistible force, so that they come together when the irresistible force meets the immovable object, kind of thing. So it's a symbol of polarity, unity of polarities, so that the unity is in the central bit. You can see there's kind of a ball in the center,
mm-hmm.
and that represents what in Buddhism is called emptiness or shunyata. It's the reality, the way things really are. And then you've got two lotuses coming out in either direction, which represent two polarities. So it's the way our minds work, really. We work in hot, cold, big, small. So we set up polarities all the time. Me, you, good, bad. We set up all these polarities in order to make sense of the world, to make a story out of our sense information, if you like. So it's kind of the world we experience. So you've got these two lotus flowers coming out on either side, and then the symbol. So this is a compound symbol. It's got lots of symbols within it. So there are five different prongs on both sides. One side represents the five archetypal Buddhas. So there are, it's very rich in tantric or Vajrayana or Tibetan Buddhism. So you have five archetypal Buddhas, each of whom represents a different quality of the enlightened mind. So if you can imagine, the enlightened mind is the ultimate value in Buddhism. And it's got lots of different facets. So wisdom, compassion, equanimity, unity. These are different facets of the enlightened mind. And different Buddhas have arisen over the centuries. So you've 2,500 years of practice and meditation. And and practitioners often have these visualizations. So they might visualize a particular Buddha. It kind of happens to them. Rather than them making it happen, it pops out and it's got a particular color. The Buddha image, it might have a particular gesture, like the hand going down, or there's another Buddha with a hand up, kind of a gesture of fearlessness, of giving fearlessness. You were saying about, you know, talking, giving advice to students in a career situation. In the sense, it's one of the greatest gifts you can give is confidence, fearlessness to someone else. So there are these various aspects of the enlightened mind that are represented, are symbolized by the archetypal Buddhas. That's in a nutshell, and that's one side of this. On the other side, you've got five prongs, which there are about half a dozen different associations with the other five prongs, the five poisons like greed, hatred, delusion, conceit, and envy. So it's like the opposite side of the Buddha's. But reality is kind of coming together in the middle of these opposites. And that's an example of a particularly rich symbol. The Vajra as a whole is seen as kind of reality as it, the way things really are, a symbol of the way things really are. Then the Vajra bell.
Sorry, what does the word Vajra mean?
The word Vajra means diamond, thunderbolt.
What's the diamond bit in that?
It wasn't in the physical symbolism. The whole thing is this kind of coming together of opposites.
Diamond.
So if you can imagine that it's powerful, it cuts through. Because it's reality, it cuts through any delusion. So that's the thunderbolt aspect of it. And so the truth is solid, isn't it? There's something indivisible about truth. Again, we're using language in quite a poetic and metaphoric, symbolic way. And then the bell, and as I said, these tend to be paired in ritual. So the bell represents emptiness, so the space inside, and the clangor represents form, and the sound of the bell is like the communication of the Buddha's teaching. So you've got lots of associations coming through. So when the practitioner is ringing the bell, they're wishing that the Buddha's message be communicated to as many people as possible. An example of symbols. And these are kind of ready-made symbols. Symbols there in a culture. But we can come up with our own symbols that are meaningful for us, from our own experience. Okay, let me give you an example. We haven't got long left, but I can give you a quick example of a section from a Buddhist ritual. And as I say, you can just enjoy or just witness. So this is the third part of a what's called a threefold puja, and it's in the third part, it involves a ritual offering of candles, flowers, and incense to the Buddha. And usually this text goes with this text. And often these rituals are done in a group context where one person recites and another person, or one person leads and everybody else kind of repeats, so it's call and response. But I can just read it so that you will get a sense of the text and the images that are involved. So this is called Offerings to the Buddha in the Threefold Puja. So reverencing the Buddha, we offer flowers. Flowers that today are fresh and sweetly blooming. Flowers that tomorrow are faded and fallen. Our bodies too, like flowers, will pass away. Reverencing the Buddha, we offer candles. To him who is the light, we offer light. From his greater lamp, a lesser lamp, we light within us. The lamp of Bodhi, shining within our hearts. Reverencing the Buddha, we offer incense. Incense whose fragrance pervades the air. The fragrance of the perfect life, sweeter than incense, spreads in all directions throughout the world. Usually there's a little bell afterwards. A very brief example of the verbal type of ritual. I'll say a few words now about mantras. So mantras are kind of sound syllables, a combination of usually Pali or Sanskrit, the ancient languages associated with Buddhism. Sometimes they have a literal meaning, and sometimes they don't. They are syllables that are symbolic. So Om is one that you've probably heard Om in many kind of Eastern contexts. So it's very much there in both the Hindu and the Buddhist tradition. And books are written on the meaning of Om. It's kind of a universal reality. Could go on. Muni is, so that doesn't have a literal translation, but Muni does have a translation which is sage. Maha means great, so great sage, Maha Muni. Shakya Muni, so it's the sage of the Shakya clan. So if you might remember that the Buddha was born into the Shakya clan. His father, according to the story, was the chieftain of the Shakya clan. And Svaha is, how to translate that, honour and praise. Alleluia.
Yeah.
So Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha is a typical mantra, and the focus of this mantra is the historic Buddha. As I mentioned, there are actually various Buddhas have developed through visualization practices, but this Buddha represents the historic Buddha. If you look around you at those tankas, you'll see other archetypal Buddhas. And they're different colours, and they've got different gestures, and there are all sorts of symbols associated with them, different objects that they're holding, maybe lotuses. This is Green Tara, for example. But this mantra, so each one of these figures, archetypal figures, will have a mantra associated with them. So there's a sense in which the mantra invokes the energy of the qualities of the enlightened mind that these images, these visualizations, these archetypal Buddhas represent. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you an example of this mantra, and I'll chant it to this, which is a Shruti box, traditional Indian instrument. And I think it'll take us to finishing time. Yep. Om Muni Muni Maha. that's an example of a mantra. And it can be a meditation. It can, just the repetition of the mantra can help you develop a concentration, just like the breath can be an anchor for the attention, the mantra can be an anchor. And also the fact that it's involving the vocal cords, it tends to hold the attention and it engages the body, so it can bring one very much present to it. Sometimes you would chant a mantra with the beads, so they're called malas, like a rosary beads, and you can count the number of malas. You might decide, oh, I'll do 108. Traditionally, a mala beads will be 108 beads, so you can, you know, finger them, and that's another physical kind of bit of contact, and it can help concentrate.
Chanting mantras sort of a part of a Buddhist tradition then?
Yes.
Okay. So I just a few months ago, last year at some point, I did a kind of like a late night yoga course class thing, and at the end, maybe for 45 minutes,
wow,
we sat and chanted
right.
For a really long time, and it felt very powerful. It was a different mantra to that. And it was incredible, but I don't think it was really explained at the time to me what we were going to do in this late night yoga course, and that it was going to end with chanting. I never knew where the link was, or that was linked to Buddhism as well.
So Buddhism kind of comes out of the older Vedic and Brahmanic tradition, but actually is a revolution in a sense, works in contrast to them. And I could say more about that next week. In fact, that's exactly where we're going next week. We're looking at the historic context. So we'll see how Buddhism came out of an existing rich tradition within India. So, you know, mantras predate Buddhism, but the Buddha would have taken on, and because Buddhism started in India, it used a lot of the traditions, the stories, the practices that were developed prior to it, the meditation techniques. But it kind of revolutionized. There was a little twist in the tale that changes everything, in a sense.
Well, so was the mantra, so would a mantra for, because actually that's what my daughter got given it for, to learn meditation.
Okay.
So prior to Buddhism, were the Indian people already using mantras?
Okay,
for sure.
Wow.
So it really goes back.
Yeah, it goes back something like 3,000 years, I think, that they've evidence of mantras in the Vedic tradition.
Wow.
So.
Amazing.
Again, they're like symbols, but sound symbols rather than visual symbols.
Yeah.
And the sense is that they can stir up those latent, dormant energies within. I'm not sure how you found it. 45 minutes is quite a long.
It was like incredible. I think I cannot remember the mantra exactly, but it was something about a connection to your mother, and I was going through with problems with my mum at the time, so I ended up crying during it. It was very kind of emotional.
Quite stirring.
Yeah.
And that's the metaphor I use with mantras, that by invoking the energies of the enlightened mind, you know, that Buddhism basically says we have those qualities within us already, but it's a question of how do we connect with them and remove the obstacles to them.
Just very quickly say what that means again.
So, om is that symbol, that kind of, that we can't quite put a rational description. Muni is sage.
Sage.
It can also mean quiet one, or sage, and kind of associated.
Wise.
Maha is great. So, sage, great sage. Shakya is the clan that the Buddha was part of. So it's the sage of the Shakya clan, and Swaha was kind of glory be.
Okay, yes. So.
So back in the day, they would have been, it wasn't an abstract thing to chant, that they were actual words. These are actual translations. It would be like us chanting, you know, great, wise one, you know. It would be like...
Yes, but with the added difference that maybe we'd be chanting it, this is going back to the Catholic reference, in Latin. And there'd be a certain resonance to our, the sacred language, as it were.
That's a really good parallel. Yeah. And is that Pali?
So this is Pali.
Okay.
Sometimes there's Sanskrit.
Yeah,
Pali and Sanskrit are very related. Yeah. Sanskrit's the older language.
Okay.
Pali was a language that was developed in order to write down the Buddhist scriptures. Again, I'll talk about that next week, I think. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming.